I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. The midterm election is less than a month away. The Florida governor's race is neck and neck between Republican incumbent Rick Scott and Democrat challenger Charlie Crist. But a third candidate is gaining ground in the polls. Libertarian Adrian Wiley is touring the state. He's challenging the candidates on their spending and tax policy, as well as their stance on education. He joins me in the studio to talk about his policy platform and his plans for Florida's future if he's elected. 90.7 News has reached out to Governor Rick Scott to speak with us on this program. As of this week, his campaign has been unable to schedule time for an interview. We will continue to extend that open invitation to Governor Scott throughout this election season, and we do hope he'll be able to join this program. A conversation with Libertarian candidate for Governor of Florida, Adrian Wiley. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined in the studio by Libertarian candidate for Governor, Adrian Wiley. Adrian, thanks for coming in.
Matt, pleasure to be here.
Well, I'd like to ask you first, what made you decide to run?
It's because I saw the direction our state and our nation were going, and I couldn't sit idly by and just watch it anymore. I had to get involved. I had to do something. And I did make the decision several years ago to begin getting politically involved. And I would say this run for governor has just been the culmination of that process.
You've polled as high as 12% in some polls. Obviously, it's not enough to win the race, but what are you hoping to achieve by this?
Well, actually, the objective is to win, and we really think, we've always said that getting into the debates was mission critical, and we look at some historical precedent with third parties. One, for example, is Reform Party candidate Jesse Ventura. 1 month before the debates, he was polling at 10%. And he actually, after the debates, ended up winning the election. And we think that given the voters' disenfranchisement and disillusionment with the two-party system, with these particular two candidates, that if we get the opportunity to speak to the majority of the Florida voters, we believe that I can win this election. It is a long shot, but it's a realistic shot.
So you're saying really the polls are neither here nor there at this point?
Right, right. Well, it does show that if you consider that Rick Scott and Charlie Crist are in the high 30s, low 40s, depending on the poll you look at, and they've spent tens of millions of dollars to get there, and we're at, 11, 12%, and we've spent less than $100,000. That tells you right there that our only obstacle is reaching the people. But if we can reach enough of Florida voters, we have a very good shot because these two guys are disliked, and I'm really the only one offering real solutions in this election.
Where's that $100,000 come from, the bulk of it?
Oh, all small contributions. Mm-hmm. We're getting average, $50, $100 donations from individuals, some small business owners, but we've gotten nothing from special interest groups, nothing from large corporations. So it's a real grassroots effort and grassroots funding.
Do you think, though, if it happens that you can't get the votes to win the election in November, do you see yourself as taking votes from one or another party, or is it not really a matter of you're going to be taking votes from a Republican voter or a Democratic voter? How do you see that?
Well, I've always rejected that premise because that makes the assumption that the people's votes belong to one candidate or another, and they don't. Each person's vote is their own, and I would hope that each individual would vote their conscience, vote for the person that best represents them, not vote out of fear of some lesser evil, because really that's the process that's gotten us to where we are today with ineffective government and with, cronyism and corruption. And if you want to change government, you have to change the way you vote. So I always say that we're out there earning votes, and, it's all three candidates' jobs to convince the people that they are the right choice.
Do you think, too, that some of what might be driving people to put a check next to you when it comes to these polls is the fact that the likability factor for the other two candidates isn't that high?
Oh, without a doubt. I absolutely understand that there are a portion of people who plan to vote for me as a none of the above option. But that seems to be changing more and more as we reach more people and we break through in the media. More and more people are voting for me as opposed to voting against the other two. And that's an important thing to happen. And I think, like I said, the more people we reach, the more people we deliver our message of economic freedom and individual liberty, I believe that, you know, we have a chance to get to that magic 33.4% number that it'll take to win in a three-way race.
What goes through your mind when you see some of the ads? I mean, you mentioned the money that's gone into the ads from both the Charlie Crist campaign and also the Rick Scott campaign. What are you thinking about when you're watching these ads?
Well, one of the things that I think about is they're mostly true, which is really a sad state of affairs. But, you know, it's a symbol of what's wrong with our political system. Rather than talking about ideas, rather than, you know, standing on the records and saying, here's my plan moving forward, it's as if they're just trying to scare people, make the other guy more terrifying so they'll vote for me out of a defensive measure. And, you know, while we're out there saying, here's our plan, here's our platform, you know, if you go to the issues page of our website, we actually say what we intend to do, where if you look at what these guys are saying, they're wrapping everything in practice sound bites and they're not giving any real answers.
Well, let's talk about some of your campaign issues, Adrian Wiley. You've got a 7-point economic plan. You highlight some cutting the state budget, cutting taxes, limiting regulation. How much do you want to cut that state budget, and how would you do that?
Well, what we're going to go after is the waste, the fraud, the abuse, the crony contracts, of which it's amazing how much money we're wasting in that. There are so many no-bid, single-source contracts going to somebody's brother-in-law that come in at 2x or 3x market value. So I intend to actually cut 30% from the state budget without affecting any critical government services. Now, when we do that, we can do some amazing things, like offering all Florida homeowners 100% homestead tax exemption. So nobody pays property tax on their home. That would put an average of $200 into you know, Florida homeowning families' pocket every month. And that is the kind of stimulus that our economy needs. Not giving some special favor to, you know, the banks or some big corporation. Let's let people keep more of what they earn. And again, I'm a small business owner, so I see a lot of the problems faced by small businesses. I know the reasons that these small businesses aren't hiring, aren't creating new jobs, aren't growing the economy. And more often than not, it's because of government hurdles in their way. That's what business owners repeatedly tell me. So I'm looking for ways to ensure that we remove some of the mindless and unnecessary regulatory hurdles from these businesses while still maintaining the ones that make sense on a state level.
I've read somewhere that you've mentioned a figure of about 30% as a in terms of what you're going to cut from the state budget.
Right.
I mean, that's a lot of money. That's like $20 billion or something.
Yes.
That's going to have an impact on probably not just programs that you say are wasteful, but other things that are necessary too. So what are your thoughts there?
Well, actually, if you look, if you go through the entire budget, and I've got it sitting on my desk, it's about 374 pages of fine print line items. But there's no department in our state government that doesn't have a huge amount of waste. Government, by definition, is completely wasteful. There's actually incentives for government employees at the end of the fiscal year to spend a whole lot of money because, hey, we've got all this extra money in the budget. We've got to get rid of it or we won't get it next year. Well, my philosophy is if we should be enticing those government employees to find ways to save. Let's say, hey, if you return X amount of your budget to the state coffers, we'll pay everybody a bonus for that because you're saving the state money. But the natural result of baseline budgeting is at the end of the year, everybody is just spending like drunken sailors because they have to make sure that they don't lose funding next year. That's a problem, and we should incentivize saving in state government.
What are your thoughts about things like regulating, you know, the use of the environment,
right,
springs and rivers, those kinds of things in Florida? Is that somewhere where you would see a need for resources and for some kind of oversight? Are you saying that doesn't really fit with the model you're talking about of less regulation?
Oh, no. The problem is right now, and I do consider myself an environmentalist. I'm a third-generation native Floridian. I don't support offshore drilling. I don't support fracking, anything like that. But what I've seen is government actually has become a polluter protection racket. And government has actually become the ones who are causing our natural resources to be exploited. And you brought up water. One example is, you know, the state of Florida has been acquiring land specifically up in the panhandle at a great rate recently. And they have specifically focused on land that has freshwater springs to the aquifer. Well, as soon as they acquire that land by forcing private property owners off of the land in some form or another, they go and they give a permit to Nestle Waters to pump out millions of gallons of water out of our aquifer per day. And these permits usually cost the companies like Nestle Water $250 a year. That's the problem. It's not – these organizations no longer protect the people. They protect the special interests. They protect the corporations. So we have to end that corruption before we can get to a reasonable approach to how do we really want to go about environmental regulation. Because I don't want to see our environmental hurt, but our environment hurt, our estuaries, our ecosystems damaged. But that's what's happening today, and it's happening with the full blessing of government because they've been bought off by the special interests.
Where is the kind of line, though, between, you know, individual rights, somebody who, maybe a small landowner who wants to do something on their property and somebody coming in saying, look, you can't do that, it's going to be bad for the environment, or what you're doing here might cause a problem for somebody who's got a well, like, a couple hundred meters away.
Right. Right. Well, I think that people should be free to use their property as they see fit, so long as they're not harming anyone else. And if they have a discharge into a well that's shared, or if they are dumping something into a river or severely polluting the air that's affecting the people around them, then yeah, that's a problem. They have infringed on the rights of someone else, and it's government's role to protect the rights of the people that they're infringing upon. But by the same token, a lot of times, much of what we do is arbitrary, and much of what we do actually has an ulterior motive that instead of protecting the people around it, actually benefits someone else who is trying to acquire that individual's property rights. Wetlands, designation of wetlands is one of the ways that they use to devalue properties, private properties, to the point where the state can acquire them and that they can bring in industries for the mineral rights or the water rights. And that's happening quite a bit. In fact, in reality, I'm opposed to Amendment 1 on the ballot because it's exactly – that's what it's all about. It's not actually about protecting our environment. It's about acquiring land at taxpayer expense that will be used by the largest exploiters of our resources, Big Sugar, the mining industries for phosphate, things like that, water companies. So that's an issue, and we have to get rid of that corruption before we can really go back and say, now that we have a level playing field, how are we going to go about protecting the environment?
What are environmentalists saying when you bring these ideas in front of them? Because there are a lot of folks who are on the green side of the spectrum saying that Amendment 1's a good idea.
Yeah, and when I actually explain it to them, when I explain everything that's going on, like, for example, the Lake Okeechobee discharge, that is completely the result, which is affecting the Indian River Lagoon and the Caloosahatchee. That is absolutely the result, direct result, of interference by the Army Corps of Engineers, by the federal government. When I talk to them about the pollution in the St. Johns River in Jacksonville, that is being done with the blessing of both the Florida Department of Environmental Protection and the EPA. And it's killing the St. Johns River, yet the people of Duval County in Jacksonville have no recourse because those polluters just say, hey, we're within government tolerances. That's a problem. And when I explain that to environmentalists, they say, oh, I didn't realize that's how it really works. But having spent so much time in Tallahassee, having watched how these systems work, I realized that a lot of times when these government agencies and these politicians talk to you about one thing, they're actually doing the exact opposite. And Amendment 1 is a prime example of that.
I mean, I'm wondering if you see any kind of middle ground. Is there a way to accommodate big businesses, businesses that need and want to use resources, and private landowners, regular citizens who obviously have a desire for the environment not to be compromised?
Oh, sure, sure. And business owners, large business owners, are always going to take the path of least resistance. And right now, the path of least resistance is buying off EPA and FDEP and buying off the proper legislators to make sure that they have everything that they need. In the future, the better way to go is for these guys to realize that if they harm the environment, they may be faced with, for example, a multi-billion dollar class action lawsuit from the people. And they are going to make the smart decision, the proper fiscal decision to be good stewards of the environment because of that potential risk. But now with the government protection, they don't have to be. So just that simple change would actually make them more beholden to the people that they serve and provide a better service to the people that are their customers.
Mm-hmm. The Department of Environmental Protection, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, that would be one of the agencies you would be cutting money from?
Absolutely. They have a lot of redundancy, a lot of overlap with, for example, the Fish and Wildlife Commission. Also, they are riddled with corruptions. That is, and I've done a series of investigation on corruption into the FDEP, and they're one of the worst offenders. So, yeah, you can guarantee there'll be some cuts in that area.
Let's talk about education. Now, this has been a center of attention in the election. Both Charlie Crist and Rick Scott are promising more money to public education. What's your plan?
My plan is, first and foremost, to reverse Common Core, to repeal Common Core. I've got a very big problem with the federal takeover of our local schools, with the federal government dictating the curriculum and the path that our local schools must take. I believe in local accountability. I'm a product of Florida public schools. Both of my boys went to public schools here in Florida. My youngest is still in high school here in public school. And I can tell you that if I ever have a problem, I can pick up the phone, get my school board member on the phone, discuss the problem, and more than likely make a positive change. Whereas with these Common Core, with everything moving up to the federal level, the local parent, teacher, student, they lose all ability to influence the curriculum, the course of the schools. So that's a real problem for me. Now, as far as spending goes, when you really look at how much we're spending per K through 12 student, we're spending an average of $12,000 per student per year here in Florida. That's combined state and local funding. Now, that is an insane amount of money. If that money was actually reaching the classroom, the average classroom would have a budget of $400,000 per year. So we could pay a teacher a great salary. They wouldn't have to go to Walmart for supplies. We could have the arts, music, we could have sports, you know, all types of extracurriculars. But what's happening is all of that money is being wasted in the bureaucracy. It's being blown through crony contracts like to Jeb Bush's brother, Neil Bush, who's one of the curriculum providers under Common Core. So we need to not only get the control back to the local level, we need to find ways of streamlining the process to get the funding to the local level. So I believe we can actually cut the education budget and get more money to the classrooms. We can do both.
I'm speaking to Libertarian candidate for Governor Adrian Wiley. I'm Matthew Petty. You're listening to Intersection. You can join the conversation. We're on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. You can also get to us on Facebook and send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Back to education, Adrian Wiley. What about the issue of standardized testing? I mean, that's also been a kind of a hot button issue in this election season. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not a big fan of high-stakes standardized testing. I don't necessarily have a problem with it, especially if it's performed on the county level. But AFCAT gave us a very good indication of what that type of high-stakes testing does to both the teachers, the students. I know my kids, when it was AFCAT time, they were completely stressed out. Their teachers were stressed out. Everybody's worried. I mean, for some teachers, it could mean their job or their paycheck, depending on the scores. So it got to the point where we were simply teaching kids rote memorization of the answers to the AFCAT rather than teaching them critical thinking and how to learn. We were just teaching them to memorize a test, and I've got a real problem with that. And Common Core just doubles down on that. It actually makes more standardized testing and more requirements like that. So that's really one of the reasons I want to go back to allowing teachers to teach and allowing students to learn. And all these big programs do exactly the opposite of that.
What about incentive pay? What are your thoughts on that for teachers?
I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but when you tie it to the standardized testing, especially what we experienced on the with the FCAT, it creates such an environment of, you know, just everything becomes about the test. I think we should take a lot more things into consideration, when it comes to incentive pay. So I'm not opposed to the concept at all. I think that is a good concept, but the way we're doing it now is not the right way.
Bright Futures, that's another issue. Obviously, there's a lack of funding there. Is that one of those programs you would say, get rid of it, we don't need to be funding that?
You know, I think that's a program that should be phased out. And this is going to be an unpopular opinion, but I do want your listeners to think about this. I think we've created a culture that says everybody needs to go get a four-year business degree or a liberal arts degree. And what ends up happening, I talk to a lot of students, and I talk to so many people who are in their 20s who are $60,000 in debt and can't find a job because everybody in the world has a four-year liberal arts or four-year business degree. And yet, if you go around the corner, there's big signs saying hiring electricians $30 an hour, hiring plumbers, you know, $25 an hour. And if you talk to the people who actually learned an effective trade, they're not $60,000 in debt, and they're making a very good living. They're putting away money. They've got enough money to feed their family and invest and have great vacations. So I think that our culture of telling everybody they have to go to college, they have to get that four-year degree, and I'm a prime example of that. I do not have a four-year degree. Everything that I needed to know along the way, I was self-taught. I founded my own business. I've worked as an application engineer for a defense contractor. A wide range of opportunities have presented themselves without that. And, you know, so it may be an unpopular position, and it may not be what people want to hear, but I do want people to think about that, because more often than not, the negative results of that four-year degree don't outweigh the benefit.
So would you have some program to put money into, say, apprenticeships, something like that?
I would love to see something like that. More trade programs, more apprenticeship programs, more, letting people through shorter term, secondary education, learn a trade, learn a skill, something that they can keep with them for the rest of their lives. And you know, after 10 years, if they do become a tradesperson, maybe start their own business in that field. And I think that is a much better step off towards the entrepreneurialism that I believe is the best path for our country.
Just circling back to the issue of Common Core, what would you say to the argument that, you know, without it, if Florida were to opt out, our students here would not be able to compete nationally for better education and better jobs?
I totally disagree. Since the implementation of, standardized testing, there's no evidence to show that we're any better than we were. I think that if we have 67, and when I say 67, I mean the counties in the state of Florida, if we have 67 laboratories of invention for what the best method of teaching our children is. Well, let's say if we have Orange County come up with a great plan and the kids there are doing extremely well. Well, you know, Polk and Lake and Seminole are going to want to emulate that. Next thing you know, Miami-Dade finds a little better way to do it, and we tweak it there. That's the right approach. Let's almost introduce competition between the counties for the best way to educate our kids. And I think that's a good way to go.
I want to ask you, too, about something which you've hit the headlines for. You spent some time in jail
That's right.
Driving without a license.
Yes.
What's going on here? What's your motivation for bringing attention to that?
Well, you know, it's actually a protest and a legal challenge to something called Real ID. And if your listeners are not familiar with Real ID, I would encourage them to take their driver's license out and look at the upper right-hand corner and see if you have a gold star. And please don't do this if you're driving right now. But if you do, you're actually part of the Real ID system. And all that extra documentation that you submitted, the birth certificate, Social Security card, some cases marriage license, divorce decree, bank statements, utility bills, that all got scanned into a national database. The other component of that I find even more frightening is when they stood you up before the blue background to take your photograph. They're not just taking a photograph anymore. It's actually a biometric digital facial image capture that is uploaded into a facial recognition database. That database is managed by the Department of Homeland Security and accessible by law enforcement throughout the nation. And they're now actually integrating this with surveillance cameras in various areas. I know in Pinellas and Hillsborough County, they're doing it with public surveillance cameras. They're doing it in stadiums. They're doing it in public places. And they're identifying people as they pass by these cameras instantaneously from the facial recognition scan from their driver's license. Now, to me, that's a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. So I refused to renew my driver's license 3 years ago, and I've been challenging the constitutionality of the Real ID Act since that time. And unfortunately, that has resulted in me having to be arrested on a couple of occasions. It's resulted in me spending a lot of time in a courtroom arguing Supreme Court precedent and things of that nature. But I feel it's important. I am a big proponent of civil disobedience, like great men like Martin Luther King and our founders engaged in civil disobedience when they found something to be unjust. And I think that's one of the ways that we have to do it. And I'm currently driving without a driver's license now. I'll leave the studio, get in my car, and drive out of here without a driver's license. And I'll continue to do so until we can fix this bad law that infringes on our constitutional rights.
Let me just circle back to the ads. And we talked at the start of the conversation about the amount of money that's been spent. Rick Scott and the Republican Party, as well as Charlie Crist and the Democratic Party, have spent more than $52 million on television ads. The political commentators we speak to here at 90.7 say this is probably the most expensive ad campaign in terms of negative ads ever. Do you think you're at a disadvantage? I mean, you've got $100,000 and you're up against these megalith kind of campaigns here. Does that sort of strike you as a disadvantage?
Well, in a lot of ways it is a disadvantage because we're being outspent literally 1,000 to 1. We've raised $100,000. It's estimated that Rick Scott will raise as much as $100 million. Charlie Crist will probably be in the tens of millions. But in another way, it's almost an advantage because the end result of the two of them attacking each other nonstop on the TV airwaves is that nobody likes either of these guys. So they're looking for a third option. So when we get the opportunity to reach people and say, hey, I'm here. I'm a third option. Here's where I stand. The response we get is phenomenal. So in a way, it's a disadvantage. But in another way, they're just, hurting each other and by proxy, helping me and hurting themselves.
When Rick Scott took office, he was, a favorite of the Tea Party.
Right.
I'm wondering, at this point in this election cycle, do you find that Tea Party supporters are coming to you and sort of more receptive to your ideas than they might be to the Republican candidate?
Yes. We get a great response from the Tea Parties. But it's funny. We also get great responses from groups like Occupy and Pride events and things like that. So I think you've got the traditional right and the traditional left that are both very, very unhappy with their candidate. I think that presents us with the opportunity to be that alternative, someone that may not appeal to 100% of the Tea Party values or 100% of the, more left group values, but someone that they can say, I like about 60% of what he says. I'm going to go ahead and vote for him. Whereas the disgust and disillusionment with the other two candidates is just causing them to back away from them.
Final message for the voters leading up to November, Adrian Wiley?
Well, I would say to the voters that your vote doesn't belong to anyone else. Your vote is yours and yours alone, and you should cast it for the person that you believe in. I have a lot of people telling me that, I don't agree with you, but you told me the truth. You told me where you stood. I know where you stand, and I believe you believe what you're saying. So I ask you to vote your conscience this time, because if you want to change government, you first have to change the way you vote.
I've been speaking to Libertarian candidate for governor of Florida, Adrian Wiley. Adrian, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Florida gubernatorial candidate Democrat Charlie Crist spoke with me last week. You can listen back to that conversation at wmfe.org/intersection. 90.7 News has also reached out to Governor Scott to speak with us on this program, and as of this week, his campaign has been unable to schedule time for an interview. We'll continue to extend that open invitation to Governor Scott in this election season, and we hope he'll be able to join the program. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.